And we're here.
We are here.
This is the Baylor College of Medicine Residence Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric Anderson.
And I'm the other host, Brandon Garcia.
And I'm Philip Burkhart, writer of this episode.
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking with Dr. Daniel Muscher, who is a infectious disease doctor and also teaches some of the infectious disease course to the medical students here at Baylor College of Medicine. We're really excited because he's a bit of an institution here. So he's
very colorful fellow.
Yes, and has given us a lot of great clinical pearls about, you know, how to detect things from syphilis to
Haemophilus,
yes.
And it doesn't seem like that much of a jump,
yeah,
but it might be.
And pneumococcus.
Gram stain in between.
Yes, and pneumococcus. He loves gram stains. So, Philip, you want
to... We're excited to talk to him today because we're going to be looking a little bit about performing research as a clinician, which is one of his big topics he likes to bring up in class. And to start that off, I think we're going to talk a little bit about the history of kind of what the physician and the relationship to medicine has been kind of in the past and how it still reflects that today a little bit. The physicians in the past were always kind of learning and trying to seek new knowledge and doing experiments of their own with patients or with what they saw. And we're going to talk to Dr. Muscher on how he's still doing that today.
Yeah, so I guess to start with, do you want to tell us a little bit about maybe some famous physician scientists, if you will, in history?
Yeah, I think my favorite one by far is Dr. John Snow, famous for his cholera outbreak map and father of epidemiology. I think he's a really cool story on how that even before germ theory, you know, he didn't know what was causing this illness, and everyone was thinking that this cholera outbreaks in London at the time in the 1850s were due to the bad air, and he didn't really have a good microbiology understanding. Nobody did on what could be a different answer to that question, but he was able to just map out kind of what he saw and realize that it had to be this water, the famous one being the Broad Street pump.
I was just about to say, wouldn't it, like, he found like one single source that was the source of all the cholera in the city?
Yeah, for a specific outbreak, yeah. He just kind of went around, talked to his neighborhood. It happened to be the neighborhood he was practicing near. And he has a famous map where he has the little black bars of every case, and it all just centers around the pump. And a couple of the pieces of evidence that were very helpful to him were people that were outside of this area but had traveled and used this water. And it kind of spurred the idea that illnesses could be from something else. And it was just something else other than this bad air that we know now it sounds really silly, but was the predominant, you know, idea at the time. And I think an interesting to hear from Dr. Muscher is going to be that a lot of times, you know, we look back on these stories and it seems obvious, like bad air, you know, we know so much better than that now. How could they have thought that? But there's things that are still being discovered now that, you know, in a couple of years then look pretty obvious. And I think it's be interesting to hear how people make those realizations to start with. I think that's an interesting thing.
Well, and a really interesting thing about this too is that it's all before the germ theory was really like,
you know,
Koch and Pasteur and all the doctors in the late 19th century who came up with this.
Yeah, and I like to hear from it as kind of like a way to look at things, like a way to notice these discoveries that, you know, kind of change the way people think about certain things. And I think Dr. Muscher himself, just to kind of further plug him, did that with Haemophilus in a way that he kind of discovered that it was an infectious cause of pneumonia when other people weren't looking at that. And so I think that's something we're going to hear from him, you know, and later in this podcast. And I really like to hear about how he approaches these questions.
Yeah. So you want to lead us in?
Yeah. So, you know, like we've been talking about, Dr. Muscher is with us today. He's a infectious disease clinician, works primarily at the VA here in Houston. He originally got his medical degree from Columbia University and did his residency and fellowship at Tufts University. And we're really excited to have him on the podcast today. All right, today with us, we have Dr. Muscher. I'm very happy to have him here. So Dr. Muscher, just to start us off, can you describe to us how you came to Baylor and the VA and what your current position is?
I was raised in the Northeast. I'd almost never been west of the Hudson River and never south of the bottom of Manhattan, except to go to the museums in D.C. The military stationed me in Texas, and I love the place. The people are so nice, especially after having been raised in Manhattan. So I actually met my wife in Laredo, Texas, went back to Boston for training, and since my professor was well known, I was offered jobs at a lot of places. But my wife's family was in Texas, mine was in Manhattan, and I didn't think I could afford to teach medicine and raise a family in Manhattan. And I loved everything I saw about Texas. Baylor offered me a wonderful job. It's been wonderful since the day I arrived in 1971. It's been my only job, and I love it, and that's why I'm here, that's why I've stayed. My specialty is internal medicine. My subspecialty is infectious diseases. And a lot of you younger folks forget that, but we are internal medicine physicians first, and the subspecialty is something that's added on.
Well, many of us first years, and really anybody that's come through the Baylor program, will know that you give many lectures for the infectious disease block. We're curious, can you tell us a little bit about some of your research?
May I first tell you how I selected infectious diseases as a specialty?
Absolutely.
I love internal medicine, and I didn't even think about, quote, subspecializing when I was younger. I thought I would practice internal medicine. But it did seem to me that if there was some area in which I could have special expertise, I would feel more fulfilled as a physician. And among the subspecialties, infectious diseases is the broadest because it's not based on a particular organ or organ system. And I think that was actually part of my conscious reason for choosing infectious diseases as a specialty. Now, when I went to my fellowship, I never planned to do research. I majored in college in medieval studies. I took the shortest number of requisite science courses to be able to apply to medical school. And I did adequately in them just by cramming for exams. But I did love medicine. The more I got into medical school, the more I loved it. And by third and fourth year and by internship, I just was totally in love with internal medicine. When I decided I wanted to subspecialize, I picked infectious diseases for the reason that I told you. I still never planned to do research. Dr. Louis Weinstein, who was one of the two great infectious disease physicians in America the last century, offered me a fellowship. And his fellowship program was 1 year as a chief resident, his chief resident, working personally with him every day, and then 2 years in research. And when I arrived, he switched it. I think he had the feeling that Musher would take that first clinical year and then vanish. So he made me do research the first 2 years. And at first I thought it was like cooking, and I hate cooking. But what I realized is that research gives you the opportunity to answer clinical questions that are unanswered. And I will say that throughout my internship and residency, every day I was raising questions, and my fellow residents would comment on it, the attendings would comment on it, like, Musher, why are you asking so many questions? I said, because it's interesting, and there's a lot of stuff that's not known. So any of the research that I've ever done has been based on clinical problems, specifically. And from the very first research that I did, you can see the clinical basis for all of it. Some has been laboratory intense. Some has been new techniques that are widely used, developed by me in the laboratory, but they were all to answer clinical problems.
You make a good point about how you can discover new things that maybe people haven't noticed. And specifically, you know, we know about your work on Haemophilus influenza. And I'm curious, with your work, I think some papers that you released in the early 1980s that showed that it was a common cause of pneumonia in older men. Can you tell us how you noticed this trend?
I love the question. the way to do it is to look at data. Yeah. So patients are admitted to the VA hospital. They have pneumonia. They cough up a good sputum sample, and you look under the microscope, and you see zillions of little teeny tiny gram-negative coccal bacilli. And then the culture plate shows just about pure Haemophilus influenzae. And the textbook says, well, Haemophilus influenzae doesn't cause pneumonia in adults. And I said, well, but it does. I mean, here I've got a case, and here I've got another case, and here I got another one. So I did, for a period of a year, look at all the gram stains of all the patients admitted to pneumonia, not every single one. My subsequent research, I tried to do every single one for one of the studies I did, but I looked very conscientiously at the gram stain and the culture results. And there were a lot of them that had Haemophilus influenzae. Now, at the time, this was in the late 1970s, I began doing this research. The Haemophilus vaccine for little kids had not been introduced. And Haemophilus influenzae type B was a major cause of disease in little kids. But nobody thought it was a cause of disease in adults, because by adulthood, almost everybody had acquired antibody that was reactive against the polyribosyl phosphate capsule of H flu type B, whether by having been exposed to H flu type B or by being exposed to other bacteria that had capsules with that reacted immunologically similarly. So adults didn't get H flu type B disease, and these Haemophilus, when we sent them out to be typed, they were non-typable. And quite seriously, they were regarded as laboratory contaminants. But I said, look, they got a pneumonia syndrome. They got inflammatory exudate accumulating in the lungs. What they cough up reflects what's in the lungs. And you look on the glass slide, and there's loads of polymorphonuclear leukocytes. That's not present in a normal lung. And there are loads of these bacteria, and there aren't any other bacteria. So it seems to me that's indicating that those bacteria are causing pneumonia. Well, it wasn't so easy. I had to, quote, convince people. So I decided that I would try to determine whether people who had Haemophilus influenzae pneumonia had antibody to their Haemophilus at the time they were admitted. And if they didn't, did they develop antibody when they got over it? In other words, an acute and a convalescent serum. So to do this, you've got to go through an institutional review board, and it takes a lot of work, and a lot of the research I've done is just because I've got a lot of, no particular brilliance, just a lot of hard work and energy. So I'd identify patients, get their permission, take their blood, spin down the blood, store away the serum, collect blood from them a few weeks later, save their organism, and then look to see the bactericidal effect of serum, because antibody to Haemophilus kills the Haemophilus because it's a gram-negative organism. And I showed that a lot of them had some minimal or moderate bactericidal activity at the time of admission. But 2 weeks later, their serum just wiped out these organisms. So it was a very distinct documentation of emergence of antibody. And that is basically the way in which I got the work published. So I showed it was just clinical observation with looking at laboratory results myself and thinking about them. But then the way to get the world to accept it was to develop a laboratory technique and show that antibody did emerge. I also had to learn how to do studies of opsonization, in which you expose the Haemophilus to serum when the patients just were admitted, and then expose Haemophilus to serum obtained a few weeks later, and then incubate those Haemophilus with white blood cells. Got to radiolabel them first. It's kind of complicated. You radiolabel them, incubate them with white blood cells, and you see which ones are taken up by the white blood cells. and the ones exposed to the convalescent serum were taken up very nicely by the white blood cells, and the ones that were exposed only to the acute serum were not taken up by white blood cells. So I showed antibody in two different ways, and that's what made the world accept it.
And just for people out there who might be unfamiliar, but that basically shows, because they took it up, that shows that the immune cells had been exposed to it prior?
It shows that there was not only bacteria present in the lung, but there was an immunologic response to those bacteria, proving that they weren't just, quote, colonizing.
Right.
They were actually getting into the system, and the body was making antibody to them.
From just sitting in your lectures, you always bring up things that you've worked on almost in every aspect of the field and major discoveries like this that you've made. And I think, obviously, there's other people treating these patients that aren't making these discoveries that you are. So I'm wondering if you could kind of describe to us your mindset on how you approach your day-to-day work with these patients that help you come up with these questions and these discoveries.
Okay. How I work with patients is I like taking care of patients. I like people. I sit and chat with them. I visit with them. But that doesn't necessarily affect my scientific thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I ask, how does the disease come about? And that's why in my lectures I emphasize pathogenesis. Why is this person getting a disease and somebody else isn't getting a disease? So I'm as interested in why some people don't get disease as in why some people do get disease. And then I go looking for the differences.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also say that it's just having just being very curious, curious about things, intellectual curiosity. I'm Jewish, and the Jewish religion literally forces you to ask questions. I don't think a lot of people who aren't Jewish know that. You're forced to ask questions. The Talmud, which is that very lengthy series of books written by the rabbis in the 2nd to the 5th century, is not full of answers. It's full of disputes and discussions, and a lot of questions go unanswered. So somebody who takes that stuff seriously and is raised that way says, oh, man, there's a question. And you ask questions, and may you get an answer, you may not get an answer.
That's a very interesting point. And actually, I think I remember from a previous conversation with you, you, in your undergraduate studies, were studying an ancient Jewish scholar. Is that correct?
It is true.
Or medieval.
I did medieval studies at Harvard, and I was studying Christian theology because that's what was taught. And I actually was really an expert on St. Augustine. Like, I was a super expert on St. Augustine. Once I was a junior, the chairman of history at Harvard called and asked me a question about St. Augustine.
Wow.
It was kind of amazing. But anyway, I came to the end of junior year. I had to write an honors thesis, and I was going to write one on Meister Eckhart, the Christian mystic theologian from the 13th century. And one day I said, you know, I'm Jewish. Why should I write on a Christian mystic? I'm sure I can find some Jewish mystic to write on. So I did. I don't know if you can eliminate all this from the podcast if you want. My grandfather was a very famous rabbi and professor in the 20th century. He's the one who first had girls become bat mitzvah. There never had been a bat mitzvah before. He was the first one to found a Jewish community center. I mean, he had a major influence. But he was kind of very non-mystical in his thinking. So I went to visit him at the Jewish Theological Seminary. I said, Grandpa, I'm interested in writing an honors thesis in college on a Jewish mystic. So he basically laughed because he's so anti-mystic. He says, but let's ask Abraham Joshua Heschel. And you guys may be too young to know that name, but he was the great mystic Jewish theologian. He's the one who marched with Martin Luther King.
Oh, wow.
Very, very big name. He said, let's go down the hall and ask Professor Heschel if he's got an idea for you. So Heschel is the one who suggested that I do my honors thesis on Bachya ibn Pakuda, who was, in fact, a 10th to 11th century Jewish, Judeo-Arabic philosopher with certain mystical tendencies. So Yes, I was interested in mysticism and theology. I think the liberal arts training is a much better discipline to be a good and thoughtful physician than the usual pre-med training, the usual one. That's not someone who really loves science and is interested and is taking science because he or she loves biochemistry or biology or whatever it is. But lots of pre-meds are just taking a certain number of courses so they can get the medical school, and I don't think that's any kind of good training at all.
I mean, I'm also partial to that. I was a music major, and I remember taking a class on historical performance practice, which is essentially how nobody really knows the quote, true way a Bach song is supposed to be played, right? Because there aren't any notations, modern notations. People sort of just infer them. And so you have to think, like, well, like, then what is the true way? And then you basically get to the point where there is no true way. Nobody really knows what it was in his head. And I think you could probably get a lot of parallels to medicine with that in some ways.
One of the most important philosophers of history was in the 1950s was a British historian / philosopher named Collingwood. And he helped to clarify what we all do. He said, you've got to put yourself into the shoes of the person whom you're writing about to see what he possibly was thinking and how he or she might have reacted and why. So it leads you again, you can see, to questioning. What are the reasons? What's the motivation? And that's the same kind of reasoning that applies in medical investigation as well. How do these things come about? How does it happen that this person does this, or this immune system does this, and that immune system does something else, or this organism does one thing, and that organism does something else? In class, you might remember, although I am absolutely not an expert in virology, herpes 1 virus and herpes 2 viruses are almost identical, just ever so, most minimal differences, and they behave biologically differently. The reason? Still not known. I think that's fascinating. If I were a younger guy, I think I might take that on as an investigation.
So Dr. Mushier, why do you like to teach medical students?
I love teaching medical students because they ask questions that are different and interesting. They haven't yet been brainwashed by the medical establishment to accept all the stuff that's in the textbook of medicine. So it's a great experience. And I get asked questions at the end of my lectures. First of all, you've heard me. I get asked questions to which I don't know the answers. But I get asked questions sometimes nobody's ever asked before, to my knowledge. And they're just fascinating.
Well, I like you always tell us to email you after.
Precisely. Yeah. I get questions by emails.
Yeah.
And about practicing, when you talk to patients, you get ideas about the way the disease evolves.
Wow. Well, I have a historical question that I think we have to ask because we're here at Baylor, and I know you're an institution at Baylor now yourself.
No, I'm just I'm a survivor.
Did your time at Baylor overlap with Dr. DeBakey?
My time at Baylor overlapped with Dr. DeBakey, and I had a couple of experiences that I'm willing to describe.
Yes.
Search committee for a new chief of staff at the VA. And Dr. DeBakey was on the search committee. So I got to sit on a committee with Dr. DeBakey. And the two final candidates were a surgeon and a psychiatrist. And Dr. DeBakey listened to people discuss it. And he said, you know, a surgeon works in an operating room, works with nurses, OR nurses, and residents, and post-op patients. A psychiatrist works with patients in psychiatry wards, but he or she does consultations all over the hospital, works intimately with social workers, and with social support, and with pharmacy, and with all kinds of other issues So, says Dr. DeBakey, I think in general a psychiatrist is a better choice to be chief of staff of a hospital than a surgeon. Now, how do you like that? Wow. Is that amazing?
Yeah.
Subsequently, my wife and his wife became friendly. So we were invited to his house a number of times. He was a fascinating man, really, really brilliant. He was the one who engineered the separation of Baylor College of Medicine from Baylor University. Yeah. I don't know if you know that.
Familiar with it, okay. But don't know details.
Well, the reason is that Baylor University, because of its religious requirements for students and faculty, was not allowed to accept federal grants. And DeBakey said a medical school can't survive without federal grants. So obviously it took a lot of negotiation. I'm sure there were a lot of egos that were involved.
Yeah.
But he did get the medical school to separate from the College of Medicine. The next thing he engineered was incorporating the VA fully into the Baylor teaching system. A College of Medicine doesn't have enough money to pay all the salaries for all the faculty it needs. But a federal hospital needs to be covered by physicians. So he created the idea of a dean's committee in which they were representatives of the VA and the Baylor College of Medicine. And all appointments of physicians at the VA hospital since 1969 have been made by or approved by the dean's committee, which means they've been approved by the Baylor College of Medicine and by the VA. So everyone at the VA basically is involved in some way or another in teaching. Now, if you think about that, I told you originally I wanted to teach medicine. And I did, by the time I finished this fellowship of mine, I wanted to do research. So I needed an institution that would support me, would give me sufficient time to do my teaching and to do the research. Well, the VA was willing to do that under these guidelines. So I was therefore willing to come and be a VA physician. Boston VA didn't have this arrangement, and I wouldn't have dreamed staying in Boston to the Boston VA. Houston VA was first-class faculty, first-class citizens, because it was fully integrated into the teaching system. That was DeBakey's doing. So the guy was obviously a brilliant surgeon who was apparently a very good engineer also, because some of his stuff took engineering skills. And he also had brilliance and foresight in administration. So I think the guy was a super genius. He actually was very nice when you met him personally and socially.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. We're always curious here to hear about the great Dr. DeBakey. We see his name all over the place, right?
I kind of had a question more about staying up to date on current papers and being able to, I guess, pull back from those later papers as well. How do you, in medicine and being in practice as long as you have, how do you make sure that you're up to date?
It's a very good question. It's harder. It's much harder because there's so much more that's known. And that does drive people to subspecialize. I do think it's unfortunate because a lot of the folks who are doing subspecialty medicine forget the fact that I emphasize that first we were internal medicine specialists before we subspecialized. Mm-hmm. When I graduated medical school, the whole textbook of medicine, I think, was 1,100 pages long with big print and big margins. Mm-hmm. The infectious disease textbook at the present time is 4,000 pages with tiny print, no margins whatsoever, and it's just as incredible. When I started on the faculty, I did read 12 or 13 journals regularly. I'd sit down at 10 o'clock at night after the kids went to bed, and I would either read literature or write manuscripts from 10 until 2 every morning. So I really pushed myself, and I deprive myself of sleep, because when I'm on vacation, I sleep 8 hours a night like everybody else. But I just didn't let myself do it. And as an intern and as a resident, I read voraciously every night, no matter how late it was. I had a resident who inspired me and drove me to do this when I was an intern. First week, Musher, what'd you read last night? Dr. Greco, I went to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. How much could I have read? Musher, you could have gone to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. What did you read last night? The guy was ferocious. He became the head of medicine at Roosevelt St. Luke's in New York. Wow. He was really, really good. So he got me started on this path, but I read. We were on every other night, but we didn't work anywhere near as hard as you guys work when you're on at night, because I just covered my patients and the other, one other intern's patients, and not that much happened. Now you're on every fifth night, which means you're covering your service and four others, so it's all night long. So I was there at Bellevue, and you work for a few hours, and Bellevue had a wonderful library. I'd sit there and I'd read. I remember reading Good Pastures, original article. I think it was American Journal of Medical Sciences, 1919. I'm sure people are pulling out their computers to fact check me. I remember Harvey Cushing's experiments on increased intracranial pressure and the effects on blood pressure and pulse. I think that was 1904-5. It was 1904-5, and that was American Journal of Medical Sciences. I read, there was something called Hammett-Rich syndrome, which is now really acute onset of interstitial lung disease. It was described by two pathologists at Johns Hopkins, Hammond and Rich. Rich was also the great pathologist that described TB. I read their articles. I read Circulation beginning in volume one. I just read it, 13 years of Circulation.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, every thought was a bit crazy, but I loved it.
Yeah.
Then for 6 months, I was in the Bellevue Chest Service, and we were on every third night. This was an unbelievable luxury. So I'd work one night, I'd read one night, and I'd go out one night. I go see Shakespeare productions in Central Park. In wintertime, I go ice skating in Central Park. I went to theater, movies, whatever it was. So I loved my internship and residency. Anyway, I did read a lot when I was junior faculty. I read 12 or 13 journals. And that was beginning in 71 when I first came to Baylor. And I kept up that pace through the early 80s. And then I started to reduce the amount of reading, because journals that used to publish once a month were now publishing every 2 weeks, some of them every 1 week. That it just wasn't possible, wasn't humanly possible to keep up. And now I read the major medical journals, which is Annals of Internal Medicine, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, and the major journals in my field, which is Clinical Infectious Diseases, Journal of Infectious Diseases, Lancet Infectious Diseases. And every article that they refer to that I'm interested in, I read. I do write a number of sections for Up to Date, so I have to stay up to date with those. Because I write articles, I've got to be reviewing literature all the time. I'm upset. I just submitted an article to Lancet Infectious Diseases. They wanted only 30 references. I had 50 references. I had beautiful. I had references back to 1915. I mean, all kinds of gorgeous references. Wow. I had to cut them out. It bothered me to cut them out.
I've never heard of a journal wanting fewer references.
They do.
Wow.
They do. Clinical Infectious Diseases allows you 40 references. New England Journal of Medicine allows you only 40 references.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
I wanted to just quickly, you mentioned Bellevue, and it's a historic hospital, and I think it's important for people at Baylor to know about it, because, you know, I think that's where the ambulatory program originated in America and, I guess, the world. And as you were just quoting, like, the library that it has, because it's been around since, I think, the smallpox in the 18th century. Can you tell us anything special that you noticed about it, or was it just like any other hospital?
Well, every hospital has its own culture.
Yeah.
at Bellevue, it's interesting, there were three medical schools that each had separate services at Bellevue. NYU had an NYU service. Columbia had a Columbia division. That's what I was on. Cornell had a Cornell division. Each of us thought that we were better than the others. And there was a lot of pride. We really tried to do very good work.
Yeah.
It wasn't beautifully equipped. It wasn't like Columbia Presbyterian,
right,
which is where the fancy residents and the fancy patients went. It was just Bellevue. And in those days, Bellevue was near the Bowery, which you guys probably don't even know about, but now what is now Soho in Manhattan that is so gentrified was slums. And at the foot of the 3rd Avenue L, that's the elevated subway, was where what we would now call homeless people would stay. Except it was against the law to be homeless, so you'd have to go find somewhere to stay at night. But basically, that's where they were, and that's who our clientele was. We also had lots of patients from Chinatown. The Lower East Side had large Italian population, large Jewish population. Many of these were either immigrants or their parents had been immigrants and brought them as little kids, or at most they were born here and raised here, but they were first generation and barely. So there was a tremendous diversity of population, tremendous diversity of disease. We worked terribly hard. There were no politics. That's what I loved about Bellevue.
Yeah.
At Bellevue, there was so damn much work to do, you didn't have time to jockey for power or importance. You just had to do the work. And I did love the work.
Well, and that's a good point, because it's a public hospital, and it was like one of the first public hospitals, correct?
This is it is exactly right. Historically, it was, and it was a place where they introduced some of the important good nursing practices. And I read a history about it, and as you say, it began, there were the precursors were in the late 1700s, I think. And then by mid-1800s, it was really starting to grow and to flourish.
I feel very lucky to be here at Baylor and have that same sort of public hospital training here at Bentaub.
Oh, yeah. Bentaub is amazing.
It's such a good resource as a student to be able to see that kind of diversity.
Bentaub is it gives you exactly that experience. I did round at Bentaub when I first came. My first couple of years I rounded at Bentaub, and I sure did like it, but it was just so disruptive to drive from the VA, to drive over here and park, drive back.
The VA has also been helpful in your clinical work because you have like a longitudinal population that you see for a long time. Is that correct?
That's terribly important.
Yeah.
And that's actually why, well, it's one of the reasons that the VA provides such extremely good care. I will mention that in addition to my working there, in addition to being a veteran, about 20 years ago, I stopped getting health care anywhere else in Houston. I get all my care at the VA as well. I think in general, the average ordinary VA patient gets better care than my financially comfortable friends and family do in Houston.
Wow.
So I do like the place, and we have the way of following our patients because they come to us and they stay with us.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. So if you want to do a longitudinal study, you can do it at a VA. At the Bentaub, it's hard because people drop in and drop out. And the same thing with the good private hospitals. They may choose to go to St. Luke's this month, and they may choose to go to Methodist, and they may go off to the Mayo Clinic or to God knows where, and the records are all scattered about, and you can't do those same kinds of studies.
Transitioning from clinical practice to more a personal life question, you mentioned in your internship years you were able to go out and see some Shakespeare productions and those kind of things. Do you just want to share with us how you're able to incorporate the rest of your life, with your career, hobbies, and that sort of thing.
Okay, fair enough.
I was long-winded. I apologize.
No, it's I'm long-winded.
You have a lot of cool stuff to say.
Yeah, ask me a short question and get a long answer. I played the violin in high school. I was good. I played, but I practiced a half an hour, 40 minutes a day, that's all, but very carefully. I got to college. I played more. They made me concertmaster of the college orchestra. I played much more. It was 1 week, sophomore year in college, I played 40 hours of music.
Wow.
I was really proud of that. I decided in medical school I'm certainly not going to stop. And even as an intern and a resident at Bellevue, I found a room where I could take my violin and practice. So nights I was on call, I could practice.
Oh, wow.
And I have played several times a week ever since. So my whole life I have. I play string quartets almost every week. My son Benjamin, who is a really good violist, plays in, and we're fortunate we play with some very good professional musicians in town. So music is a very big part of my life.
I have to ask, did you raise your son to be a violist so he could accompany you in these? That seems a little too convenient.
Important question. I raised him to be a violinist, and I kept begging him. I said, Benjamin, he was a kid, Benjamin, please learn to play the viola. Dad, I'm busy. Because he's also a wonderful ball player, too. You wouldn't know that. He's an astonishing ball player. I don't know where the genes came from.
And a physician. He's on staff here.
He's an astonishing physician.
Does it all.
That's absolutely true. But anyway, and then he went off to college, and he actually sang in college. So he was in the Harvard Glee Club, and he was one of the a cappella groups. He was the musical director of the a cappella group. So were my other kids. All my kids did singing. So we didn't even play the violin much in college, but he came home one winter. Oh, and I offered him $100 when he was in high school. I said, Benjamin, I'll give you $100. Learn to play the viola. He came home one Christmas break. He says, okay, Dad, I'll play the viola. He picked up the viola. He now plays the viola.
Wow.
So that's kind of how that came about. I raised him to be a violinist. Now, my youngest one wanted to play the flute. I said, Deborah, you know, there are two chairs for a flutist in the orchestra, and there are hundreds of young people who want that position. There are 8 or 10 chairs for cellists, and the back four of them are never filled. So it's true. I made her play the cello, and she's petite. And every time she picked it up, she gives me this soulful look, like, Daddy, why did you do this to me? I wanted to play the flute. But she played the flute, the cello, and she played in the orchestra in high school. She stopped in college. The oldest one played piano. I made her play viola. So I did have a string quartet when the kids were growing up.
The truth comes out.
I played violin. Benjamin played violin. Rebecca played viola, and Deborah played cello. We had a little string quartet.
That's amazing.
So, and then when they set up the Medical Center Orchestra, I was the concertmaster of that from the opening till about 5 or 6 years ago. And we rehearsed with the orchestra one night a week, so I played quartets one night a week and rehearsed with the orchestra one night a week.
Wow.
I do love Shakespeare. I never miss a Shakespeare play in town. I read a lot, try to read a novel a week, and just don't let myself sleep.
I think you also mentioned that you take part in a lot of the activities with the Jewish community.
Oh, yeah, that's true. All three of my kids, I'm pleased to say, are what you would say, they're competent liturgically. That means that they can stand up and lead any service in correct Hebrew with the correct melodies.
Wow.
That's what a professional cantor does, but they're able to do that. And they've all done that. They can read from the scrolls, which requires a special chant. They can read the prophets from the book, requires a different chant. They can lead services. And I was able to learn those things as a kid, so I passed those skills along to my kids. It's true.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We know that you're busy, so we really appreciate you taking the time to come over here, too.
I'm honored to have been asked. I thank you very much. I'm not sure what a podcast is. I don't do social media, but if anybody's interested, I'm glad they'll be interested. Anyone definitely, have to call me, you know where to find me.
Great. Yeah, well, we definitely appreciate all your lectures in infectious disease. Yes. So we just, you know, wanted to hear more about you.
Definitely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, that's it for now. We'd like to thank everyone who took the time to listen to this episode of the podcast. Special thanks to Philip for writing the episode. Thank you to our faculty advisor, Dr. Poitras, for helping us put everything together. Thank you to the Baylor Communications Department for helping with the production and website. And thank you again to Dr. Musher for taking the time to be interviewed by us. We hope everyone enjoyed it and hope you tune in again soon. Goodbye for now.